You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You're hearing the voices of hundreds of thousands of protesters live from Tahrir Square in Cairo this morning. We have Nicholas Kristof with us, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. But first, let's hear some other voices coming out of Egypt. Here's President Mubarak speaking last night.
The youth of Egypt, stationed in Tahrir Square and nationwide, I address you all with a speech from the heart, a speech from father to his children, to his sons and daughters.
Mubarak sees himself as the father of Egypt. We spoke to actually a father of one of the protesters. He talked to our partner, the BBC, just after President Mubarak finished speaking. Here's what he had to say.
We are all expecting that he will say that he's stepping down and returning back to be an ordinary citizen, and to submit to the people's request and delegate his powers to the vice president or whatever he was going to delegate to. Yet, he's staying as the president, which is, I don't understand. And he mentioned that he is not clinging to power or he is not a power seeker, but it doesn't seem this way. He's been 30 years a president and he's still in holding to this power.
Joining us again, Nicholas Kristof, a correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Nick, I'm reading your latest tweet, which says, growing crowd at Cairo Presidential Palace could be a flashpoint. Lots of soldiers and tanks there determined to protect it. Determined to protect the palace, not the crowd.
Yes, the palace and Mubarak. It's one of the most fortified places in Cairo. And initially, the protesters had been reluctant to go there, partly to avoid that kind of confrontation. But now there is a growing crowd there just to try to figure out some way of getting the message to Mubarak.
It does sort of feel as though Egypt is kind of balanced on the edge of a razor, doesn't it? And I'm wondering where our eyes should be. Should they be on Omar Suleiman and his threat to use police tools? Should they be on Mubarak himself? Should they be on the crowd? Should we be watching the military?
I would say watch the military in particular. I mean, I think we essentially have a stalemate where Mubarak and Suleiman have dug in their heels and are just determined not to go. And we've got a growing crowd that is determined that they do go. And the military is going to be really in the position of breaking this stalemate. I am somewhat nervous that there may be differences of opinion within the military, some kind of a divide there. But there will certainly be a lot of pressure from a lot of people in the military to try to break this stalemate and in one way or another. And I think they, at this point, see both Mubarak and the protesters as an impediment to the kind of stability and order that they aspire to.
Well, let me kind of get a feel for what you think about the pressures that that the military is experiencing in Egypt right now. I have to assume that the United States, secretly at least, is putting pressure on the military not to open fire on the protesters. Would you agree?
Yes, I would.
Therefore, that would beg the argument that the United States has some sort of pull with the military, whether it's because of our close relationship with Egypt's army and our advisory capacity, whether it's because of the estimated $1.5 billion in aid we give to the military. At this point, the United States could be making some calls saying, don't you dare fire on your own people.
We have influence, certainly. I mean, not least, as you say, because of that money, that those checks we write, and also because so many senior Egyptian officers have trained in the U.S. But where we tend to lose that leverage is on issues of regime survival. And so, I mean, the fear is that if you do get some top generals who decide that, look, the only way that I'm going to stay in power, that my family is going to continue to earn hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes, is to absolutely crush these protests any way we can, then at that point, American protests may not amount to very much. There have been, this kind of a movement is not unique. There have been very similar protests in lots of countries around the world, and sometimes they end peacefully, and sometimes they end violently. And usually, what what makes the difference is the willingness of the army or some other security force to obey presidential orders to fire on protesters or crush them in some other way. There's, I think, a lot of reason to think that the Egyptian military would be extremely reluctant to do that, not least because it is very proud of the fact that it did not fire on protesters when Sadat wanted it to during the bread riots, and that's part of its kind of mythology. But, you know, at some point there may be some generals who may think, oh, that's the only way.
Well, let me ask you real quickly about what role you think the Muslim Brotherhood may play in all this. There is a possibility that, contrary to many people's fears, the Muslim Brotherhood could be sort of a steadying influence on as we move forward. Do you think?
Well, I think that we have vastly exaggerated the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think we've turned it into a kind of a boogeyman in this country. And I mean, a couple of points to make. One is that the Muslim Brotherhood is not the same as al-Qaeda. In fact, they hate each other. They're enemies. A second is that the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, I would think it would be a disaster if it actually ran the country, but there's no reason to think it ever would. Its support seems to run somewhere between about 10% and 25% of the population. There was just a new poll that came out that seemed to be, you know, about the most rigorous opinion poll recently, and it showed, if I remember right, 15% of people giving approval to the Muslim Brotherhood and only 1% supporting its candidate in a presidential poll, a straw presidential poll. So it's part of the fabric. It has some support, but it's also much better that it be inside the tent rather than outside the tent. It's, after all, under, you know, our pal Mubarak that you had people like Ayman al-Zawahiri, who
went on to become the second in command at al-Qaeda. Absolutely. Nicholas Kristof, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thank you so much. We will continue bringing you all the news from Egypt all morning long on The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.